Near the usual moon, a smaller second moon hangs, like a slightly shriveled green pea.
My daughter must have awakened, the girl thinks.
The two moons cast the shadow of her heart and mind.
Her heart gives a shudder.
The world has changed, and something is beginning to happen.
The girl hears nothing from her parents. Perhaps no one in the gathering has noticed her disappearance. That is because her other self, her Dota, has remained behind. The two of them look exactly alike, so most people can't tell the difference. Her parents, of course, should be able to tell that the Dota is not the actual girl, that she is nothing but the girl's other self, that their actual daughter has run away from the gathering, leaving the Dota behind in her place. There is only one place where the girl might have gone. But still, her parents never try to contact her. This in itself might be a wordless message to the girl to stay away. The girl goes to school irregularly. The new outside world is simply too different from the world of the gathering where she grew up. The rules are different, the aims are different, the words they use are different. For this reason, she has trouble making friends in this new world. She can't get used to life in the school. In middle school, however, she befriends a boy. His name is Toru. He is small and skinny, and his face has several deep wrinkles like that of a monkey. He seems to have suffered from a serious illness when little, and can't participate in strenuous activities. His backbone is somewhat curved. At recess time, he always stays by himself reading a book. Like the girl, he has no friends. He is too small and too ugly. During one lunch break, the girl sits next to him and starts to talk to him. She asks about the book he is reading. He reads it aloud to her. She likes his voice, which is small and hoarse but very clear to her. The stories he tells with that voice all but carry her away. He reads prose so beautifully that it sounds as if he is reciting poetry. Soon, she is spending every lunchtime with him, sitting very still and listening with deep attention to the stories he reads her. Before long, however, Toru is lost to the girl. The little people snatch him away from her. One night, an air chrysalis appears in Toru's room. The little people make it bigger and bigger each night while he sleeps, and they show the scene to the girl through her dreams. The girl can do nothing to stop them. Eventually, the chrysalis reaches full size, and a vertical split appears in its side, just as it happened with the girl. But inside this chrysalis are three big black snakes. The three snakes are tightly intertwined so tightly that no one, including themselves, can pull them apart. They look like a shiny perpetual tangle with three heads. The snakes are terribly angry that they cannot pull free. They writhe in a frantic effort to separate themselves from each other, but the more they writhe, the more entangled they become. The little people show these creatures to the girl. The boy called Toru sleeps on beside them, unaware. Only the girl can see all this. The boy suddenly falls ill a few days later and is sent to a distant sanatorium. The nature of his illness is not disclosed. In any case, Toru will surely never return to the school. He has been irretrievably lost. The girl realizes that this is a message from the little people. Apparently, they cannot do anything to the girl, Amaza, directly. What they can do instead is harm and even destroy the people around her. But they cannot do this to just anyone. They cannot touch her guardian, the painter, or his daughter, Kurumi. Instead, they choose the weakest ones for their prey. They dragged the three black snakes from the depth of the boy's mind and woke them from their slumber. By destroying the boy, they have sent a warning to the girl and are trying their best to bring her back to the Dota.
You, finally, are the one who caused this to happen, they are telling her. The girl returns to her loneliness. She stops going to school. Making friends with someone can only expose that person to danger. That is what it means to live beneath two moons. That is what she has learned. The girl eventually makes up her mind and begins fashioning her own air chrysalis. She is able to do this. The little people said that they had come to her world down a passageway from the place they belong. If that is the case, she herself should be able to go to that place down a passageway in the opposite direction. If she goes there, she can learn the secrets regarding why she is here and what the meaning of Maza and Dota could be. She might also succeed in saving the lost Toru. The girl begins making a passageway. All she has to do is pluck threads from the air and weave a chrysalis. This will take time, but if she does take the time, she can do it. Sometimes, however, she becomes unsure and confusion overtakes her. Am I really a Maza? Couldn't I have switched places somewhere with my daughter? The more she thinks about it, the less certain she becomes. How can I prove that I am the real me? The story ends symbolically when the girl is opening the door of her passageway. It says nothing about what will happen beyond the door, probably because it has not happened yet. Dota, Amame thought. Leader used that word before he died. He said that his own daughter had run away, leaving her Dota behind, in order to establish a force opposed to the little people. It might have actually happened. And I am not the only one to see two moons. Still, Amame felt she could understand why this novella had gained such a wide readership. Although it was a story about the fantastical experiences of a girl placed in unusual circumstances, it also had something that called forth people's natural sympathies. It probably aroused some subconscious something, which was why readers were pulled in and kept turning pages. Tengo undoubtedly had contributed much to the book's literary qualities, its vivid, precise descriptions, but she could not confine her admiration to that fact alone. She had to focus on the parts of the story where the little people enter the action. For Amame, this was a highly practical story, a virtual instruction manual upon which hinged the life and death of actual people. She needed to gain concrete knowledge from it, to add whatever solidity and detail she could to her understanding of the world into which she had strayed. Air Chrysalis was not just a wild fantasy dreamed up by a 17-year-old girl. The names may have been changed, but Amame firmly believed that the majority of things depicted in it were unmistakable reality, as experienced firsthand by the girl herself. Fukaeri had recorded those events from her own life as accurately as possible in order to reveal those hidden secrets to the world at large, to inform large numbers of people of the existence and the deeds of the little people. The Dota that the girl had left behind must have become a passageway for the little people and guided them to Leader, the girl's father, who was then transformed by them into a receiver. They then drove the Akebono members, who were of no use to them, into a suicidal bloodbath and transformed the remaining Sakigake group into a smart, militant, and xenophobic religious organization, which was probably the most comfortable and convenient environment for the little people. Amame wondered if Fukaeri's daughter had been able to survive for long without her Maza. The little people had said that it was virtually impossible for a daughter to go on living without her Maza. And what about a Maza? What was it like for her to live after having lost the shadow of her heart and mind? After the girl escaped from Sakigake, the little people had probably used the same process
to make more new dotas, their purpose being to widen and stabilize the passageway by which they came and went, like adding new lanes to a highway. This was how the dotas became perceivers for the little people and played the role of shrine maidens. Tsubasa had been one of them. If Leader had sexual relations not with the girls' actual mazas, but with their other selves, their dotas, then Leader's expression, ambiguous congress, made sense. It also explained Tsubasa's flat, depthless eyes and her near inability to speak. Almame had no idea how or why the dota, Tsubasa, had escaped from the religious organization, but she had almost certainly been put into an air chrysalis and retrieved to be taken back to her maza. The bloody killing of the dog had been a warning from the little people, like what was done to Toru in the story. The dotas want to become pregnant with Leader's child, but lacking substance themselves, they were not menstruating. Still, according to Leader, their desire to become pregnant was intense. Why should that have been? Almame shook her head. There was still much that she did not understand. Almame wished that she could tell this to the dowager as soon as possible, that the man might actually have raped nothing more than the girl's shadows, that they might not have had to kill him after all. But even if she explained these things, it would not be easy for her to get the dowager to believe her. Almame knew how the dowager would feel. The dowager, or any sane person, would have trouble accepting as fact this stuff about the little people, mazas, dotas, or air chrysalises. To sane people, these things would seem like nothing more than the kinds of fabrications that appear in fiction, no more real than the Queen of Hearts or the White Rabbit with the watch in Alice in Wonderland. But Almame herself had actually seen two moons, the old one and the new one hanging in the sky. She had actually been living under their light. She had felt their lopsided gravity in her skin, and with her own hands, she had killed the man called Leader in a dark hotel room. Almame did not know what the little people were hoping to accomplish by taking control of Sakigake. Perhaps they wanted things that transcended good and evil, but the young protagonist of Air Chrysalis intuitively recognized those things as not right, and she tried to strike back in her own way. Her vehicle was her story. Tengo became her partner to help get the story going. Tengo himself probably did not understand the meaning of what he was doing at that point, and he might not understand it even now. In any case, the story called Air Chrysalis was the important key. Everything started from this story. But where do I fit into it? From the moment I heard Janacek Sinfonietta and climbed down the escape stairs from the traffic jam on the Metropolitan Expressway, I was drawn into this world with two moons in the sky, into this enigma-filled world of 1Q84. What could it mean? She closed her eyes and continued to think. I have probably been drawn into the passageway of the force opposed to the little people, created by Fukaeri and Tengo. That force carried me into this side. What other explanation could there be? And the role I am playing in this story is by no means small. I may even be one of the central characters. Almame looked at her surroundings. In other words, I am in the story that Tengo set in motion. In a sense, I am inside him. Inside his body, she realized. I am inside that shrine, so to speak. I saw an old science fiction movie on television long ago. It was a story of a small group of scientists who shrank their bodies down to microscopic size, boarded a submarine-like vehicle, which had also been shrunk down, and entered their patient's blood vessels, through which they gained entry to his brain in order to perform a complex operation that would have been impossible under ordinary circumstances. Maybe my situation is like that. I'm in Tengu's blood and circulating through his body. I battled the white blood cells that attacked the invading foreign body, me, as I headed for the root cause of the disease, and I must have succeeded in deleting that cause when I killed Leader at the Hotel Okura. Almame was able to warm herself somewhat with such thoughts. I carried out my assigned mission. It was a difficult mission, that is for sure, and I was afraid. But I carried it off coolly and flawlessly, in the midst of all that thunder, and perhaps with Tengu looking on. She felt proud of what she had accomplished. To continue with the blood analogy, I should soon be drawn into a vein, spent, having served my purpose. Before long, I will be expelled from the body. That is the rule by which the body's system works, an inescapable destiny. But so what? I am inside Tengu now, enveloped by his warmth, guided by his heartbeat, guided by his logic and his rules, and perhaps by the very language he is writing. How marvelous to be inside him like this. Still sitting on the floor, Almame closed her eyes. She pressed her nose against the pages of the book, inhaling its smells. The smell of the paper, the smell of the ink. She quietly gave herself up to its flow, listening hard for the sound of Tengu's heart. This is the kingdom, she thought. I am ready to die, any time at all.
Chapter 20 Tengu
The Walrus and the Mad Hatter. No doubt about it, there were two moons. One was the moon that had always been there, and the other was a far smaller, greenish moon, somewhat lopsided in shape and much less bright. It looked like a poor, ugly, distantly related child that had been foisted on the family by unfortunate events and was welcomed by no one. But it was undeniably there, neither a phantom nor an optical illusion, hanging in space like other heavenly bodies, a solid mass with a clear-cut outline. Not a plane, not a blimp, not an artificial satellite, not a papier-mâché moon that someone made for fun. It was without a doubt a chunk of rock, having quietly, stubbornly settled on a position in the night sky, like a punctuation mark placed only after long deliberation, or a mole bestowed by destiny. Tengu stared at the new moon for a long time, as if to challenge it, never averting his gaze, hardly even blinking. But no matter how long he kept his eyes locked on it, it refused to budge. It stayed hunkered down in its spot in the sky with silent, stone-hearted tenacity. Tengu unclenched his right fist and, almost unconsciously, gave his head a slight shake. Damn, it's the same as in Air Chrysalis, a world with two moons hanging in the sky side by side. When a Dota is born, a second moon appears. That will be a sign. Watch the sky with great care, one of the little people said to the girl. Tengu was the one who wrote those words. Following Komatsu's advice, he had made his description of the new moon as concrete and detailed as possible. It was the part on which he had worked the hardest. The look of the new moon was almost entirely Tengo's creation. Komatsu had said, "Think of it this way, Tengu. Your readers have seen the sky with one moon in it any number of times, right? But I doubt they've seen a sky with two moons in it, side by side. When you introduce something readers have never seen before into a piece of fiction, you have to describe them with as much precise detail as possible." It made a lot of sense. Still looking up at the sky, Tengu shook his head again. The newly added moon was absolutely the same size and shape as the one for which he had invented a description. Even the figurative language that he had used fit this one almost perfectly. This can't be, Tengu thought. What kind of reality mimics fictional creations? No, this can't be, he actually said aloud, or tried to. His voice barely worked. His throat was parched, as if he had just run a very long distance. There's no way this can be. That's a fictional world, a world that does not exist in reality. It was a world in a fantastic story that Fukaeri had told Azami night after night, and that Tengo himself had fleshed out. Could this mean, then, Tengo asked himself, that this is the world of the novel? Could I have somehow left the real world and entered the world of Air Chrysalis, like Alice falling down the rabbit hole? Or could the real world have been made over so as to match exactly the story of Air Chrysalis? Does this mean that the world that used to be, the familiar world with only one moon, no longer exists anywhere? And could the power of the little people have something to do with this in one way or another? He looked around, hoping for answers, but all that appeared before his eyes was the perfectly ordinary urban residential neighborhood. He could find nothing about it that seemed odd or unusual. No Queen of Hearts, no Walrus, no Mad Hatter. There was nothing in his surroundings but an empty sandbox and swings, a mercury vapor lamp emitting its sterile light, the spreading branches of a zelkova tree, a locked public toilet, a new six-story condo, only four units of which had lighted windows, a ward notice board, a red vending machine with a Coca-Cola logo, an illegally parked old model green Volkswagen Golf, telephone poles and electric lines, and primary color neon signs in the distance. The usual city noise, the usual lights. Tengo had been living here in Koenji for 7 years, not because he particularly liked it, but because he had just happened to find a cheap apartment that was not too far from the station. It was convenient for commuting, and moving somewhere else would have been too much trouble, so he had stayed on. But he at least knew the neighborhood inside and out, and would have noticed any change immediately. How long had there been more than one moon? Tengo could not be sure. Perhaps there had been two moons for years now, and he simply hadn't noticed. He had missed a lot of things that way. He wasn't much of a newspaper reader, and he never watched television. There were countless things that everybody knew but him. Perhaps something had occurred just recently to increase the number of moons to two. He wanted to ask someone, "Excuse me, this is a strange question, but how long have there been two moons? I just thought you might know." But there was nobody there to ask. Literally, not even a cat. No, there was someone there. Nearby, someone was using a hammer to pound a nail into a wall. Bang, bang, bang. The sound kept up without a break, a very hard nail going into a very hard wall. Who could be pounding nails at a time like this? Puzzled, Tengo looked around, but he could see no wall, nor was there anyone pounding nails. A moment later, Tengo realized that he was hearing the sound of his own heart. Spurred on by adrenaline, his heart was pumping surges of blood through his body. It pounded in his ears. The sight of the two moons gave Tengo a slight dizzy feeling, as if it had put his nervous system out of balance. He sat down on the top of the slide, leaning against the handrail, and closed his eyes, fighting the dizziness. He felt as if the force of gravity around him had subtly changed. Somewhere the tide was rising, and somewhere else the tide was receding. Their faces devoid of expression, people were moving back and forth between insane and lunatic. In his dizziness, it suddenly occurred to Tengo that the image of his mother wearing a white slip had not attacked him for a very long time. He had almost forgotten that he had been tormented by that illusion for years. When could he have last seen it? He could not recall exactly, but it was probably around the time he started writing his new novel. For some unfathomable reason, his mother's ghost had stopped haunting him from that point onward. Instead, Tengo now sat on top of a slide in a playground in Koenji, looking at a pair of moons in the sky. An inscrutable new world silently surrounded him like lapping dark water. Perhaps a new trouble had chased out the old one. Perhaps the old familiar riddle had been replaced by a fresh new one. The thought came to Tengo without irony, nor did he feel any need to complain about it. Whatever the composition of this new world might be, I surely have no choice but to accept it in silence. There's no way to pick and choose. Even in the world that existed until now, there was no choice. It's the same thing. And besides, he asked himself, even if I wanted to lodge a complaint, who is there for me to complain to? The hard, dry sound of his heart continued, but the dizzy sensation was gradually subsiding. With his heart pounding in his ears, Tengo leaned his head against the handrail of the slide and looked at the two moons hanging in the Koenji sky. What a strange sight it was. A new world with a new moon. Everything was uncertain and ultimately ambiguous. But there is one thing I can declare with certainty, Tengo thought. No matter what happens to me in the future, this view with two moons hanging up there side by side will never, ever seem ordinary and obvious to me. What kind of secret pact had Aomami concluded with the moon that time, Tengo wondered, and he recalled the deadly serious look in her eye as she stared at the moon in broad daylight. What could she have offered the moon? And what is going to happen to me from now on? At 10 years old, as a frightened boy standing before the room's big door, Tengo had wondered this again and again while Aomami continued to grip his hand in the empty classroom. Even now, Tengo continued to wonder that same thing. He felt the same anxiety, the same fear, the same trembling. The door now was new and bigger. The moon was hanging there again, but this time there were two moons, not one. Where could Aomami be? Tengo scanned the area again from his perch on the slide, but nowhere could he find what he was hoping to discover. He spread out his left hand and struggled to find some clue. But there was nothing in his palm besides its natural, deeply carved lines. In the flat light of the mercury vapor lamp, they looked like the canals on the surface of Mars, but they told him absolutely nothing. The most he could glean from this big hand was the fact that he had come a very long way since the age of 10, all the way to the top of this slide in a little Koenji playground where two moons were hanging in the sky. Where could Aomami be? Tengo asked himself again. Where is she hiding? She might be very close by, Fuka Eri had said, within walking distance. Supposedly somewhere close by, could Aomami also see the two moons? Yes, I'm sure she can, Tengo thought. He had no proof, of course, but he had a mysterious conviction that it must be true. She could see what he could see, without a doubt. He balled his left hand into a tight fist and pounded on the surface of the slide hard enough to hurt. That is why it has to happen. We have to run into each other somewhere within walking distance of this place. Someone is after Aomami, and she's hiding like a wounded cat. I don't have much time to find her. But where could she be? Tengo had no idea. Ho, ho, called the keeper of the beat. Ho, ho. The other six joined in.
Chapter 21 Aomami, what should I do? That night, Aomami stepped out onto the balcony in her slippers and gray jersey workout clothes to look at the moons. She was holding a cup of cocoa. It was the first time in a very long time that she felt like drinking cocoa. But the sight of a can of Van Houten cocoa in the kitchen cabinet had suddenly inspired her. Two moons, a big one and a little one, hung in the perfectly clear southwestern sky. Instead of sighing, she produced a tiny moan. A daughter had been born from an air chrysalis, and now there were two moons. 1984 had changed to 1Q84. The old world had vanished, and she could never get back to it. Sitting on the balcony's garden chair, taking little sips of the hot cocoa and looking at the two moons through narrowed eyes, Aomami tried to recall things from the old world. All she could bring back at the moment, however, was the potted rubber plant she had left in her apartment. Where could it be now? Was Tamaru looking after it as he had promised? Of course.
There's nothing to worry about, Almame told herself. Tamaru is a man who keeps his word. He might kill you without hesitation if necessary, but even so, he would care for your rubber plant to the end. But why am I so concerned about that rubber plant? Almame had barely thought about the thing until the day she left it behind in her apartment. It was nothing but a sad-looking rubber plant, its color pale and dull, its poor health obvious at a glance. It had carried an 1,800 yen price tag in a special sale, but the cashier had further dropped the price to 1,500 yen without being asked, and if Almame had bargained, it might have gotten cheaper still. It had obviously remained unsold for a long time, and all the way home she had regretted having bought it on impulse, not only because it was sad-looking, bulky, and hard to carry, but because it was a living thing. That was the first time in her life that she had owned something alive. Whether a pet or a potted plant, she had never bought one or received one or found one. The rubber plant was her very first experience of living with the thing that had a life of its own. The moment she had seen the two little red goldfish in the living room and heard from the dowager that she had bought them for Tsubasa at a night stall in a street fair, Almame had wanted to have her own fish, badly. She could hardly keep her eyes off them. Where had this desire come from all of a sudden? Perhaps she felt envious of Tsubasa. No one had ever bought Almame anything at a street fair, or even taken her to one. Ardent members of the Society of Witnesses, faithful in every way to the teachings of the Bible, her parents had disdained and avoided all the secular world's festivals. And so, Almame had made up her mind to go to a discount store near the station in her Jiugaoka neighborhood and buy a goldfish. If no one was going to buy her a goldfish and bowl, then she would do it herself. What's wrong with that? She had thought. I'm a grown-up. I'm 30 years old and I live in my own apartment. I've got bricks of money piled up in my safe deposit box. I don't have to ask anyone's permission to buy myself a damned goldfish. But when she went to the pet department and saw actual goldfish swimming in the tank, their lacy fins waving, Almame felt incapable of buying one. She could not help but feel that paying money to take ownership of a living organism was inappropriate. It made her think, too, of her own young self. The goldfish was powerless, trapped in a small glass bowl, unable to go anywhere. This fact did not appear to bother the goldfish itself. It probably had nowhere it wanted to go. But to Almame, this was a matter of genuine concern. She had felt none of this when she saw the two goldfish in the dowager's living room. They had appeared to be enjoying themselves swimming in their glass bowl so elegantly, the summer light rippling through the water. Living with goldfish seemed like a wonderful thought. It should add a certain richness to her own life. But the sight of the goldfish in the pet department of the discount store by the station only made Almame feel short of breath. No, it's out of the question. I can't possibly keep a goldfish. What caught her eye at that point was the rubber plant over in a corner of the store. It seemed to have been shoved into the least noticeable spot in the place, hiding like an abandoned orphan. Or at least it appeared so to Almame. It was lacking in color and sheen, and its shape was out of kilter, but with hardly a thought in her head, she bought it. Not because she liked it, but because she had to buy it. And in fact, even after she brought it home and set it down, she hardly looked at it, except on those rare occasions when she watered it. Once she had left it behind, however, and realized that she would never see it again, Almame couldn't stop herself from worrying about the plant. She frowned hugely, the way she often did when she wanted to scream out loud in confusion, stretching every muscle in her face until she looked like a completely different person. When she had finished distorting her face into every possible angle,
Aomame finally returned it to normal.
Why am I so concerned about that rubber plant? In any case, I know for sure that Tamaru will treat the plant well. He is used to loving and caring for living things. Unlike me, he treats his dogs like second selves. He even uses his spare time to go through the Dowager's garden, inspecting her plants in great detail. When he was in the orphanage, he risked his own life to protect a younger boy with impaired abilities. I could never do anything like that, Aomame thought. I can't afford to take responsibilities for others' lives. It's all I can do to bear the weight of my own life and my own loneliness.
Loneliness reminded Aomame of Ayumi. Some man had handcuffed her to a bed in a love hotel, violently raped her, and strangled her to death with a bathrobe sash. As far as Aomame knew, the perpetrator had not been taken into custody. Ayumi had a family and colleagues, but she was lonely. So lonely that she had to experience such a horrible death. Still, I wasn't there for her. She wanted something for me, that was certain. But I had my own secrets, and my own loneliness, that had to be protected. I could never share them with Ayumi. Why did she choose me, of all people, when there are so many others in this world?
Aomame closed her eyes and pictured the potted rubber plant that she had left in her empty apartment. Why am I so concerned about that rubber plant?
Aomame spent the next several minutes crying. What's wrong with me? She wondered, shaking her head. I'm crying too much these days.
Crying was the last thing she wanted to do, but she couldn't stop the tears. Her shoulders trembled.
I've got nothing left. Anything of value I ever possessed has disappeared, one thing after another. Everything is gone, except for the warmth of my memory of Tengo. I've got to stop this crying,
Aomame told herself.
Here I am inside of Tengo, like the scientist in Fantastic Voyage. Yes, that's it. The movie's title was Fantastic Voyage.
Satisfied that she had recalled the title, Aomame calmed down and stopped crying.
No matter how many tears I shed, it's not going to solve anything. I've got to go back to being the cool, tough Aomame. Who wants that to happen? I want that to happen.
She looked at her surroundings. There were still two moons in the sky.
That will be a sign. Watch the sky with great care, one of the little people, the small-voiced one, had said.
Ho, ho, said the keeper of the beat. Just then, Aomame noticed something. She was not the only person looking up at the moons. She could see a young man in the playground across the street. He was sitting on top of the slide and looking in the same direction that she was.
He is seeing two moons, just like me,
she knew intuitively.
No mistake. He is looking at what I am looking at. He can tell. There are two moons in this world. But Leader had said that not everyone living in this world could see both moons.
There was no room for doubt. This large young man was looking at a pair of moons in the sky.
I'd bet anything on that. I can tell. He's sitting there, looking at the big yellow moon and the small, lopsided, greenish, mossy-colored moon. He appears to be thinking hard about their meaning. Could he, too, have drifted into 1Q84? Maybe he's confused, unable to grasp the meaning of this new world. Yes, that must be it. That must be why he had to climb to the top of the slide in this playground at night, staring at the moons all alone, mentally listing all the possibilities, all the hypotheses he could think of, and examining them in detail. But no, that might not be it at all. He could be working for Sakigake. He could be here looking for me. The thought set Ah Mama's heart racing. Her right hand unconsciously reached for the automatic pistol in her waistband, tightening on its hard grip. It was impossible, though, to find any sense of tension or urgency in the man on the slide, and there was nothing about him that suggested violence. He was just sitting up there alone, his head against the handrail, looking straight up at the moons in the sky, absorbed in his own thoughts. Ah Mame was on her third-story balcony, and he was down below. She sat in the garden chair, looking down at the man through the gap between the balcony's opaque plastic screen and the metal railing. Even if he were to look up toward Ah Mame, he would probably not be able to see her. But in any case, the man appeared to be completely engrossed, staring at the sky without the slightest sense that someone might be staring at him. Ah Mame calmed herself down and quietly released the breath that she was holding in. She relaxed the tension in her fingers and took her hand from the pistol. Maintaining her position, she continued to observe the man. From her vantage point, she could only see his profile. The playground's mercury vapor lamp cast its bright light on him from above. He was a tall man with broad shoulders. He had a stiff-looking head of hair, cut short, and he wore a long-sleeved T-shirt, its sleeves rolled up to his elbows. Not exactly handsome, but he had good, solid features, and the shape of his head was not bad. If he were a little older and his hair thinning, he would be quite nice-looking. Then Ah Mame suddenly knew. It was Tengo. No, she thought, that couldn't possibly be. She gave her head several short, sharp shakes. No way. I must be wrong. Things don't work out like that. She found it impossible to breathe normally. Her body wasn't working right. Thought and action refused to sync. I've got to take another good look at him, she thought. But for some reason, she couldn't get her eyes to focus. Something seemed to be causing the vision of her right and left eyes to become hugely different all of a sudden. She unconsciously twisted her features out of shape. What should I do? She got out of her garden chair and looked around helplessly. Then she recalled that there had been a small pair of Nikon binoculars in the sideboard, and she went in to get them. She hurried back to the balcony, holding the binoculars, and looked at the slide. The young man was still there, in the same position, in profile, looking at the sky. With trembling fingers, she focused the binoculars and looked at his profile close up, holding her breath, concentrating. No doubt about it. It was Tengo. 20 years might have gone by, but she knew for sure. It could not be anyone but Tengo. What most surprised Ah Mame was that Tengo's appearance had hardly changed from the time he was 10, as if the 10-year-old boy had aged directly into a 30-year-old man. This was not to say that he looked childish. His body and his head were, of course, far bigger than they used to be, and his features were now those of an adult. His facial expression had a new depth to it. The hands resting on his knees were big and strong, very different from the hand she had grasped in that elementary school classroom 20 years earlier. Even so, the aura projected by his physical presence was the same. His solid, massive body gave her a deep, natural sense of warmth and security. She felt a strong desire to press her cheek against his chest, and that filled her with joy. He was sitting on a playground slide, looking at the sky, staring hard at exactly the same things that she was looking at. The two moons. Yes, it is possible for us to see the same things. What should I do? Ah Mame had no idea what to do next. She set the binoculars in her lap and clenched her fists, tightly enough for her nails to leave marks in her skin. Her clenched fists were trembling slightly. What should I do? she listened to her labored breathing. Before she knew it, her body seemed to have split down the middle. One half was willing to accept the fact that Tengo was right there in front of her. The other half refused to accept it, trying to convince itself that this was not happening. Inside her, these two forces clashed, each trying to drag her in its own direction. It was as if every bit of her flesh was being shredded, her joints torn apart, her bones smashed. Amame wanted to run straight to the playground, climb the slide, and speak to Tengo there. But what should she say? She didn't know how to move the muscles of her mouth. Could she manage to squeeze out a few words? My name is Amame. I held your hand in an elementary school classroom in Ichikawa 20 years ago. Do you remember me? Is that what she should say? There should be something a little better. The other Amame gave her an order. Stay hidden on this balcony. There's nothing more you can do. You know that. You struck a bargain with Leader last night. You would save Tengo and help him to go on living in this world by throwing away your own life. That was the gist of your bargain. The contract has been concluded. You have sent Leader to the other world and agreed to offer your own life. What good would it do you now to see Tengo and talk about the past? And what would you do if he didn't remember you, or if he knew you only as that strange girl who used to say the creepy prayers? Then how would you feel as you went to your death? The thought made her go stiff all over. She began to shiver uncontrollably, as if she had caught a bad cold and might freeze to the core. She hugged herself for a time, shivering, but never once did she take her eyes off Tengo sitting on top of the slide and looking at the sky. He might disappear somewhere the moment she looked away from him. She wanted Tengo to hold her in his arms, to caress her with his big hands. She wanted her whole body to feel his warmth, to have him stroke her from head to toe and warm her up. I want him to take away this chill I feel in my body's core. Then I want him to come inside me and stir me with all his might, like a spoon in a cup of cocoa, slowly, to the very bottom. If he would do that for me, I wouldn't mind dying right then and there. Really. No. Can that really be true? Amame thought. If that really happened, I might not want to die anymore. I might want to stay with him forever and ever. My resolve to die might simply evaporate, like a drop of dew in the morning sun. Or then again, I might feel like killing him, shooting him first with the heckler and coke, and then blowing my own brains out. I can't begin to predict what would happen or what I would be capable of. What should I do? Amame could not decide. Her breathing became harsh. A jumble of thoughts came to her one after another, tangled thoughts, defying all her attempts to impose order upon them. What was right? What was wrong? She knew only one thing for sure. She wanted those thick arms of his to be holding her right now. What happened after that would happen. Let God or the devil decide. Amame made up her mind. She went to the bathroom and wiped away the traces of her tears. She looked in the mirror and swiftly straightened her hair. Her face was an absolute mess. Her eyes were bloodshot. Her outfit was terrible. Faded jersey workout clothes with a weird bulge in back where she had a 9mm automatic pistol shoved into her waistband. This was no way to present herself to the man for whom she'd been burning with desire for 20 years. Why wasn't she wearing something a little more decent? But it was too late. She had no time to be changing clothes. She slipped on a pair of sneakers and ran down 3 floors on the condo building's emergency stairway, crossed the street, entered the empty playground, and walked to the slide, where there was no sign of Tengo. Bathed in the artificial light of the mercury vapor lamp, the top of the slide was deserted, darker, colder, and emptier than the far side of the moon.
Could it have been a hallucination? No, it was no hallucination, Al-Mame told herself, out of breath. Tango was there until a moment ago, without a doubt.
She climbed to the top of the slide and stood there, looking all around.
No sign of anybody. But he could not have gone very far. He was here until a very few minutes ago. 4 or 5 minutes at the most. If I run, I should be able to catch up with him.
But Ah-Mame changed her mind. She stopped herself almost by force.
No, I can't do that. I don't even know which way he walked from here. I don't want to be running aimlessly around the streets of Koenji at night. That is not something I should be doing.
While Ah-Mame had hesitated on the balcony, wondering what she should do, Tengo had climbed down from the slide and left.
Come to think of it, this is the fate I have been handed. I hesitated and hesitated, and momentarily lost my powers of judgment. And in that time, Tengo went away. That is what happened to me. It's just as well this way, Ah-Mame told herself. It's probably the best thing that could have happened. At least I succeeded in finding Tengo. I saw him just across the street. I trembled with the possibility of having his arms around me. If only for a few moments, I was able to taste that intense joy and anticipation. She closed her eyes and grasped the slide handrail, biting her lip. Ah-Mame sat down on top of the slide in the same posture that Tengo had adopted. She looked up at the southwestern sky, where the two moons, large and small, hung side by side. Until only moments ago, she had been watching Tengo from the balcony of her apartment, where her deep hesitation seemed to be lingering still. 1Q84. That is a name given to this world. I entered it 6 months ago without meaning to. And now, I am about to leave it quite deliberately. Tengo will stay here after I am gone. I have no idea, of course, what kind of world it will be for Tengo. There is no way I can see it through to the end. But so what? I am going to die for him. I was unable to live for myself. That possibility had already been stripped from me. Instead, I will be able to die for him. That is enough. I can die smiling. This is no lie. Ah-Mame struggled to feel whatever hint of Tengo's presence might be left at the top of the slide, but no warmth of any kind remained there. The night wind, with its presentiment of autumn, cut through the leaves of the Zelkova tree, removing all traces of Tengo. Even so, Ah-Mame went on sitting there, looking up at the moons, bathed in their odd emotionless light. The city sounds blended together into one urban noise surrounding her with its basso continuo. She thought of the little spiders that had spun their webs on the emergency stairway of the Metropolitan Expressway. Were those spiders still alive and maintaining their webs? She smiled. I'm ready, she thought. I've made my preparations. But there was one place she would have to visit first.
Chapter 22. Tengo. As long as there are two moons in the sky. After climbing down from the slide and leaving the playground, Tengo wandered aimlessly through the streets of Koenji from one block to the next, hardly conscious of where his feet were taking him. He tried to organize the jumble of ideas in his head, but unified thinking was beyond him now, probably because he had thought about too many different things at once while sitting on the slide. About the increase in the number of moons, about blood ties, about a new chapter in his life, about his dizzyingly realistic daydream, about Fukaeri and Air Chrysalis, and about Ah-Mame, who was probably in hiding somewhere nearby. With his head a confused tangle of thoughts, Tengo felt his powers of concentration being tested to the limit,
He wished he could just go to bed and be fast asleep. He could continue this process in the morning. No amount of additional thinking would bring him any clarity now. Back at his apartment, he found Fukaeri sitting at his desk, intently sharpening pencils with a small pocket knife. Tengo always kept 10 pencils in his pencil holder, but now there were at least 20. She had done a beautiful job of sharpening them. Tengo had never seen such beautifully sharpened pencils. Their points were like needles. "You had a phone call," she said, checking the sharpness of the current pencil with her finger. "From Chikura." "You weren't supposed to be answering the phone. It was an important call." She had probably been able to tell it was important from the ring. "What was it about?" Tengo asked. "They didn't say. But it was from the sanatorium in Chikura, right?" "They want a call." "They want me to call them. Today, even if it's late." Tengo sighed. "You don't know the number, I suppose."
"I do."
She had memorized the number. Tengo wrote it down. Then he looked at the clock. 8:30. "What time did they call?" he asked.
"A little while ago."
Tengo went to the kitchen and drank a glass of water. Resting his hands on the edge of the sink, he closed his eyes and confirmed that his brain was functioning normally. Then he went to the phone and dialed the number. Perhaps his father had died. Or at least it was a life-and-death issue of some sort. They would not have called this late if it were not about something important. A woman answered the phone. Tengo gave his name and said he was calling in response to an earlier message.
"Mr. Kawana's son?" the woman asked.
"Yes," Tengo said.
"We met here the other day," she said.
Tengo pictured the middle-aged nurse with metal-framed glasses. He could not recall her name. He uttered a few polite words, adding, "I gather you called earlier."
"Yes, I did. I'll connect you with the doctor in charge so you can talk to him directly."
With the receiver pressed against his ear, Tengo waited and waited for the doctor to pick up. Home on the Range seemed as if it would go on playing forever. Tengo closed his eyes and pictured the sanatorium on the Boso Peninsula shore. The thickly overlapping pine trees, the sea breeze blowing through them, the Pacific Ocean waves breaking endlessly on the beach, the hushed entryway lobby without visitors, the sound of movable beds being wheeled down the corridors, the sun-damaged curtains, the well-pressed white uniforms of the nurses, the thin, flat coffee in the lunchroom. Finally, the doctor picked up the phone.
"Sorry to keep you waiting. I got an emergency call from one of the other sick rooms a few minutes ago."
"That's fine," Tengo said. He tried to recall what his father's doctor looked like, until it occurred to him that he had never met the man. His brain was still not functioning properly. "So, is something wrong with my father?" The doctor paused a moment and then said,
"Well, it's not that something in particular happened today, just that his condition has not been good lately. I hate to tell you this, but he is in a coma."
"You mean he's completely unconscious?"
"Exactly."
Tengo struggled to make his brain work. "Did he come down with something that made him go into a coma?"
"Properly speaking, no," the doctor said with apparent difficulty.
Tengo waited.
"It's difficult to explain on the phone, but there is not one particular thing wrong with him. He does not have cancer or pneumonia or any other illness that we can name. Medically speaking, we can't see any distinguishing symptoms. We don't know what the cause might be, but in your father's case, it appears that his natural life-sustaining force is visibly weakening, and since we don't know the cause, we don't know what treatment to apply. We are continuing to feed him intravenously, but this is strictly treating the symptoms."
"Is it all right for me to ask you a very direct question?" Tengo asked.
"Yes, of course," the doctor said.
"Are you saying that my father is not going to last much longer?"
"That might be a strong possibility if he stays in his current condition."
"So he's more or less wasting away of old age." The doctor made a vague sound into the phone. Then he said,
"Your father is still in his 60s, not yet ready to waste away of old age. He is basically healthy. We haven't found anything wrong with him other than his impaired cognitive abilities. He gets rather good scores on the periodic strength tests we perform. We are not aware of a single problem he might have."
The doctor stopped talking at that point. Then he went on.
"But
Come to think of it, observing him these past few days, there may be